Not had enough of me yet? Well, good news. You can now listen to William Hill's Upfront with Simon Jordan podcast right here. The series, hosted by me, gives you a front row seat to big name interviews discussing their career successes and failures. Sit back and enjoy.
If I said to you in 10 years' time, name me a great Man United player of now, who would you say?
Well, I wouldn't.
You wouldn't, would you?
No.
And he said, shut up, man, they're going to do murder. And I just went, haven't it? I just went, bang, headbutted him, broke his nose.
He called you a bottler and a big-time Charlie.
Yeah, I mean, pictures. So I said, oh, cheers, mate, thanks a lot. He said, do you know who I am, do you? I said, no. So I'm your dad.
What did you make to that?
To be fair, I was shocked.
This is Upfront with me, Simon Jordan. I believe there are a lot of vacuous, uninformed, unchallenged opinions out there. I want to get to the bottom line and cut through the nonsense. So with this podcast with William Hill, I'm going to get people with strong views who think they can stand them up to proper scrutiny. There's a good chance I might learn something along the way. And more importantly, so might you.
Joining me in today's episode, a two-time Premier League winner with over 50 caps for England, beginning with breakthrough at West Ham. His 20-year career took him to Italy, Old Trafford and Anfield, achieving a fairly unique feat, representing both sides of the Premier League's fiercest rivalry. One of the greatest midfielders of his generation, Paul Ince, welcome to Upfront.
Great to be here.
One of the first things that we do, Paul, in these conversations with you guys and all you elite athletes, is get some sense of what created you, what made you. Mm-hmm. Right? Your background seems to be rather testing. You seem to have an absence of parental guidance in terms of, I think if I'm right, your father departed at two, your mother at eight. You're brought up by your aunt and uncle, is that right?
Yes, my aunt.
Yeah.
But my dad left when I was two, so I didn't really see him anyway.
Right.
My mother then had to go to Germany to find work.
Okay.
Because there was no work in
right
in England at the time. So I spent probably from that age to 10 to about maybe 14 living with my aunt.
Right.
In Loxford Lane, which is in Ilford, which was tough. It was really, really tough.
How do you, without a traditional parental background to say, how do you find football? How does football become something for you?
Well, I think for me it was a way out. You know, when I think about, you know, living at those times, and they were tough times. I mean, I used to play for my school.
Mm-hmm.
I remember every Saturday, Sunday, I used to have to come downstairs and, you know, hoover the floor and while they all sat there smoking joints and mm-hmm. playing reggae and all that type of stuff. And did it time.
They being who?
My aunt.
Right.
Friends, you know. So it was about six or seven every Saturday, Sunday.
Right.
You know. And I used to get up in the morning, Sunday morning. I mean, they literally have their feet up and I'd be sweeping underneath it. And be...
But who's got you into football? How have you got into that?
Just through school. Just through school. So I'm like, listen, you know, I'd love football, you know, playing
but
at school.
You weren't there a lot, were you?
I was for football. Yeah, listen, it's the old thing, you know, like most kids, you know, you're 10, 11, 12, you play football, played on a Saturday, Sunday when I was allowed to. And that it just went from there.
And was it an immediate ambition of yours? Obviously, once you're showing the level of talent to be a footballer, was that your thought process? This is what I'm going to do.
That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Whether it was an ambition of mine, no, I didn't realise how good I was.
Right.
You know, obviously, when I was 14, leading up to 16, I was training at Fulham.
Right.
And I also was training at West Ham at the same time. So Fulham was on a Tuesday, West Ham was on a Thursday. And the only reason why I chose West Ham was because Fulham used to train outside. And used to have this kind of gravel kind of training thing. And every time I used to make sly tackles.
Take the skin off.
Yeah.
But it would be more local to you as well, wouldn't it?
More local to me also. Yeah. But then it got to a stage where I was getting into trouble at school.
Yeah.
You know, we ended up with a little gang like people do.
Mm-hmm.
Eddie Bailey, who was the scout at the time, said to John, listen, this kid's trouble.
Right.
You know what I mean? And yeah, listen, I admit I was trouble. You know, we used to stand on the corner at Bennett's Castle Lane drinking, you probably know, large counts of tenants mm-hmm. and smoking marijuana and fags and that. But during that period where we used to stand on the corner, there used to be a couple of cars coming from the other side of the road and they used to shout like racial abuse at us all the time. Racial abuse at us all the time. And that happened kind of year after year. And I just thought to myself, I need to get away from this.
Get away from this, yeah.
It kind of made me strong as a person.
Right.
You know, having to deal with that. But it was just the fact that, you know, the fighting, people taking drugs, the abuse you're getting, like, right on the street. Cool. And I just thought, I need to try and do something to get away from
this. Was it a difficult culture for you to break out, if all your mates are in it?
Very, very.
And you've got an opportunity. By the way, when did you realise, I mean, you said earlier on a moment ago, that you didn't know how good you were. When did you realise, at what sort of age, was it when you signed on with West Ham or when you were training with both West Ham and Fulham?
Well, I didn't even realise then. I just felt that because obviously as a 13, 14-year-old kid, you're training overnight time.
Mm-hmm.
So that means if I'm training there, then I'm not standing on the street corner. Right. You know, so...
But you're quite a confident character, aren't you? I mean, one of the things that I remember of you as an observer and talking to people that have played alongside you, and I talk about a couple of them that I've spoken to, this characteristic of being a very confident bloke and a leader. So I'm curious to see, you know, you must have had a view about your own ability.
When I got to 16, got into a fight in college. There was a party going, a second year pilot party. Got into a fight and didn't think nothing of it. So then about 2-3 weeks down the line, I'm training with the first team.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, well,
this is it.
Got half a chance here.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm training well. You know, I'm holding my own for a 17-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. So then next minute, I see Ronnie Boyce walking down. The manager wants to see you. So
you know, John Lyle, yeah.
John Lyle. Yeah. God rest his soul, John Lyle.
Yeah.
He was like my father figure to me. And it was like when a headmaster calls you out of class, you're trying to think, what have I done? What have I done wrong? Walking to the office, I'm absolutely shitting myself. Because John Lowe was hard, but he was fair.
Mm-hmm.
So I walk into his office and there's two policemen sitting on the other side. They were prepared to take me away. John Lowe talked him out of it. So he said to me, call me a little pipsqueak.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't knuckle down, your career's finished. You're not at this club no more. And then that was then where the penny dropped.
Was it?
Yeah. That was my final chance.
Yeah.
You know, Eddie Bailey said to John Lowe, don't take him.
Right.
You know what I mean? He might be talented, but he's more of a hindrance than is anything else.
Two things. You said that John Lyle was almost like a father figure. Is that because you didn't have one? And ultimately he assumed that role?
Yeah, because I think in Juno's years, you're always looking for that guidance. You're always looking for something to help you. You know, I mean, when you don't see that as you get older, then you kind of feel you get lost and you don't know where to turn to. And you think, right, this is my life on the streets with my mates. And don't get me wrong, Simon, I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it. Because it was like a family.
Yeah.
You know, we all looked after each other.
Yeah.
It was all potless, you know. Yeah. So it was a family.
And they probably stayed potless.
Yeah. Mm. Well, they did. And it was a family, though. And that's what I liked about it. And it was hard to get away from that. I didn't get away from that straight away.
Why do you think John alighted upon you? What do you think he saw in you that made him want to go that extra mile to potentially get you out of shtuck with the old Bill that's sitting in front of you and also patronise you?
I think he saw talent, that's for sure.
Clearly.
I think he saw something. Yeah. But then Eddie Bailey saw talent, you know, but wasn't prepared to go the extra mile. You know, I don't know. I just felt like he wanted to take me underneath his wing.
Yeah.
You know, I think he must have understood my background, what's happened in the past, you know, my situation with my father and my mother. I just felt someone needs to just put his arm around him, you know. So I knew John Lowe thought the world of me. And I thought, am I going to throw this away? And there was times where, even after that, I nearly threw it away. You know, Friday before a game, you know, played in the youth team. I was fighting at King's Nightclub every Friday night. You know, and I thought to myself, what am I doing? You know, and it was only when I kind of probably met Claire, my wife, that changed my direction.
Is that a case of you can take the boy out of the gang, but not the gang out of the boy? Because I said this to Kel Brook, and I said, Kel, you know, you're a world welterweight champion, and you're getting yourself into the most awful situations where someone's cutting you with a machete, and you're getting yourself in this. And his answer was, "Well, I'm a boy from a council estate. You know, you can take me out of the council estate, but you can't take the council estate out of the boy." Now, at that stage in your life, was that just the state of affairs that you're still morphing into an adult, and this culture that you're leaving behind has still got its residue in you?
Yeah, and I actually feel that it's always tough leaving some, you know, gang that you've been with for 7-8 years, you know, for our school years. It's a tough situation. And I thought to myself, well, if I leave them, what have I got next? Where's the next family?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's an interesting one because I was going to ask you next, without being too personal, how it feels. Because I, you know, my parents were together. So I grew up in a stable environment where my mum and dad were together. It wasn't always the most harmonious, but notwithstanding it, it was what it was. But your father leaving at two, although you're not particularly privy to it at two, but you know you haven't got a dad as you get older because other boys will have it at school. And then your mum having to go to Germany and you being raised by your aunt. Did that create some sort of personality in you that looks for, like you just described, looks for recognition or looks for appreciation or a unit around him to make him feel wanted or part of something?
I think sometimes when you look at the situation that I was in and, you know, it was all that age where you get beat by belts and all that stuff, you know, and you do want, you cry out for help.
Guidance, certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can't see it. No matter how far you look ahead of you, you can't see it. So for me, did I give up being wanted? I'm not too sure. But I know for one thing, meeting Claire was the best thing that happened to me.
From that moment, you make your breakthrough into the West Ham side. And what was that like? I mean, you're training with the players. You're now playing in front of crowds at Upton Park. What's that breakthrough moment like for you?
It's a strange one, really, because I remember I was in the squad. I mean, he was playing a team away. Can't really name the team.
What, you 18, 19 now?
Yeah, I think about, 20, yeah, not 18, 19, something like that. Yeah. And we were getting beat 4-0. And John Lowe came, said to Incy, on you go. And I'm warming up down the touchline, and the torrent of racial abuse.
Really?
That I got. And I was hardened to it. Because I've spent 5 years on standing on Bennett's Castle Lane, getting it from white people in cars, shouting crap out the window. You know, I mean, but it was my first experience that I think, you know, we're at a football match. I don't expect this. Anyway, so we got beat 4-0. And then my debut was on the Saturday against Southampton. It wasn't the feeling I've made it. It wasn't, because I was that cocky kid. And, you know, by the time I thought, well, I felt I deserved to be there. I actually felt I deserved to be playing, you know, and obviously Jeff Pike was playing most of the time.
Yeah.
You know, I always felt, even at 19, not being disrespectful to Jeff Pike, but I was a better player than him at that time.
Right.
And he knew that, you know, because every time I used to go into the first team change room, you know, he used to just take the piss out of me in front of all the lads, you know, because he knew I was coming for his place. So when I got it, it was as, against Southampton, I knew how to make the most of it. Scored one, set up, got fouled for the penalty, Cotty scored, ended up winning 3-1. And after that, it just took that process of playing week in and week out. But I was stable then at the time. You know, I've been with Claire for a couple of years now. You know, we moved into a house.
Right.
It was a little two-bedroom house. No bath. You know, she should go to her mother's to have a clean. You've been there, Simon. You have a little box with a TV on it, you know. That, for me, that was start for me. That was the start of creating a family. And also, when I think about Claire's, and she won't mind me saying this, but Claire's dad left, you know what I mean?
Right.
So she was a single parent, you know? Right. And so, you know, there was a kind of a togetherness there.
Within 3 years, there's an opportunity for you to go to Man United. Did you feel any sort of, I mean, I think West Ham are getting relegated at that time, aren't they? In that time when Man United are showing real interest in you.
No, but what happened was, and I think we need to put it out there, because obviously we know the situation with the shirt. We played Liverpool at Anfield last game of the season, and we had to win to have a chance of staying up.
Yeah.
And I remember playing against Steve McMahon. It was tough.
Yeah, yeah.
Hard man.
I interviewed him for a job at Palace once, as a manager.
He took me out after about 30 minutes. Bang. Yeah. Night nurse.
Yeah.
Off.
Yeah.
So I only played 30 minutes. Okay, end up losing the game. I think it was about 4-1.
So West Ham get relegated, yeah?
So we get relegated.
Yeah.
So then during the summer, I'm speaking to John Lowell. I'm saying, listen, John, I'm living in this place opposite the pub. All right, I've just bought... I said, me and my wife have just bought a white XRI Cabriolet. It makes me laugh now, so I don't still think, what's I doing? What's I thinking? And... We used to wake up in the morning and the roof used to be ripped, slashed with a knife. Because Punters come out the pub, slashed the car. So I said to John, listen, Gaffer, I need to move. I need to get some more money. So we agreed that I'd sign a contract for £1,000 a week.
Right.
Okay. 3 weeks later, I heard us get the sack. I was livid. Absolutely livid. So Lou McCarvey took over.
Yep.
So I said, listen, Gaffer, Lou, just to let you know, we've had a conversation with John Lowe before. I know he's not here now, but we agreed that I'd sign a 3-year contract, £1,000, to get out from where I'm living, because it's not right for me, it's not right for my girlfriend. And he said, listen, Paul, at your age, that's a lot too much money to give you. So that was the start of it.
Right.
Okay, so then the season started. I knew mate that would be interested in me. And it was hard because, you know, when a club like Mate Night comes calling...
Well, I was going to say, put aside the nature of disputes about money and opportunities, when Man United come calling, you're playing at West Ham, and West Ham are a great club and a big club and all that goes with it, but Man United are a different kind of football club.
For sure.
So for you, that must have been a really significant moment.
So basically before the season finished, I heard rumours that obviously that Mate Night were interested in me.
Yeah.
We decided that before I go on holiday, if the deal goes through while you're away, rather than you come back to do all the poters and all the pizzazz, you know what I mean? We'll have a picture, we'll put it in the library, and if the deal goes through, we can just put your picture in the paper, simple as that. So obviously, what happened was, come back, think still at West Ham, Lawrence Lustig, who was the reporter, for the Daily Mail, was going through the library, saw the picture, put it in a paper, chaos.
Yeah.
Fucking chaos.
Right.
Okay. And it wasn't nice, you know what I mean, at all. I could deal with it. You know, I felt I was part of the problem there. But when they're abusing my Claire in the stands and all that, that was it. So had a medical at Mate United, failed that.
Right.
So,
now you think it's shit.
I've got to go back to West Ham. Yeah. And it's funny because I've played more or less every game for West Ham in the last 2 years. And Jim McGregor, who was a physio at the time, did the medical. And he said, oh, your groin's a bit tight. You've got any problems? I said, I'm 21 years old, Jim. I've just played fucking 60 games. You know what I mean? He said, oh, we can't take the risk, £4 million. Sent me back. So now I'm thinking, where do I go from here? Can't play in the first team, sitting in the stands. I was at loose ends again. You know, you start thinking back to when you've, you know, hanging out with the lads. Am I back to where I'm from? You know what I mean? You're not wanted. No one wants you. So the next minute, about 3 weeks later, I got a phone call from Sir Alex to say, listen, Paul, I've heard all the shit that's going on. I'm not prepared to let this happen. You know, fuck the medical, what they say. I'm gonna sign you.
Right.
And that's it. And I went up there. Funny enough, the day I signed, there was a big array, obviously.
Yeah.
All the cameras are there. Walk into the foyer. All of a sudden, this fucking black bloke jumps out of me and shakes me hand, going, well done, well done. And I mean, pictures. So I said, oh, cheers, mate. Thanks a lot. He said, do you know who I am, do you? I said, no. So I'm your dad.
Right.
News of Bell set me up big time.
Was it your dad?
It was my dad.
Right. What did you make to that?
To be fair, I was shocked. I was more shocked than on the Sunday because on the Sunday he did it big exclusive. So now I work at the railway station. I can't afford this. And my son won't even give me X, Y, and Z.
Right.
You know, and I just thought it was tasteless. It really was. And that was the last time I've seen him. Probably that's the first time I've ever seen him because at 2 you don't recognise your dad is anyway.
No, of course not.
And that was the first thing I had when I first joined Mate United. The first thing. But
so you're having a bit of fun, aren't you? You're coming out of West Ham and getting called Judas,
great, eh?
Getting abused. Your girlfriend, soon to be your wife, is getting abused. And then you land at Man United and the first thing you get is your dad.
They're jumping out behind the trees.
That left you at 2 years of age.
Yeah.
The United of 89 is not so much the United of the team that it became when you start winning Premier Leagues with you and other people. Mm. Did you, it seems to me, I mean, I watched one of my young players that came out of my academy, Wilf Zaha, go to Man United. And I don't think Wilf was ready to go to United.
No, neither way.
And wasn't prepared for it. He had the ability.
Yeah, for sure.
But I don't think he was psychologically prepared for the step up. But you were.
I don't think I was. I think the difference you have now, if you go back to when I was there, I had Mark Hughes there.
Yeah.
Steve Bruce.
Brian Robson, yeah.
Pallister. People who would show me the way. People who would show me how to conduct yourself.
Yeah.
And I walked in there, some cocky 21-year-old kid. You know what I mean? And any time someone said anything back to me, I bite back, because I've always felt I had to be on the defensive, because that's all I've done all my life. It's been on the defensive. Mm-hmm. You know, and when people criticise you, you feel like you have to say something back to them, you know, to show who you are. You know, you're not prepared to take this shit, even though realistically you should be listening and learning. And eventually the penny dropped. It took me a while, Simon. It took me a while. Mm-hmm. You know, 6 months. And it's right. This is what you do. This is how you conduct yourself. This is how you train. You know, you don't answer back senior players. You know, you don't ever go at them. But it was something that I wasn't used to. Again, everything I talk about reverts back to having that family feeling again.
Right.
Everything I revert to is having that family feeling. You know, signing the 5-year contract that I signed gave me stability.
Yeah.
My wife had to leave her job. And she had a very good job in BCCI. Right. So she had to leave that to come and live with me.
Yeah.
Right? So I was now looking at this and I've got a 5-year contract. Got a few quid.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got a fiance, just about to get married.
Yeah.
I'm settled. I've got a foundation. I've got a team where we all get on. We're all family. We all got egos, but we all get on. There's a family feeling about it, a culture about that. We're a family. And that's all I actually ever wanted.
Yeah.
You know, so to have that was fantastic, because I never had it growing up. So I appreciate that. You know what I mean? And I don't want that to end. So when you see a changing room fragment, mm-hmm. and they go into little kind of bubbles and a little...
Factions.
It kills me.
Yeah.
I hate it.
Right.
Because I want everything to be, everyone to be together. You know what I mean? So to go into a change with that was unbelievable. And to learn from those people, what it takes to play for Man United. Pip Sahar, as you said, was a very talented player.
Mm.
But what they got to understand is that you have to perform week in and week out. You have to train well. You can't take your foot off the gas.
But it's a different level of expectation.
Of course it is. The expectation from the punters, 80,000 people.
From the media.
From the punters, from just playing for this huge
football club.
You can't go out. Yeah. The camera's in your face. Listen, I get social media. How I look at this, I think to myself, how would I cope playing for Man United if there was social media? I don't know. I could never answer that question.
Are you surprised at the demise of Man United? Are you surprised this culture? I look at Man United and think of this wonderful culture that built this football club with players like you and other players that over the years that understood what it was like to play for Man United, understood the responsibility of what was meant to be a Man United player. It doesn't feel like this group of players over a significant period of time have got it.
When I look at Manchester United, I've looked at it for the last 6-7 years. They've lost their presence.
Yeah.
They haven't got a presence. We used to beat teams just by standing in the tunnel.
Yeah.
Teams now go to Old Trafford and think they can get something. Now, Man United now play like counter-attacking football. You know, are we ever going to get the Man United of old? No, we're not. Where it's full-flowing wingers. We're not going to do that. But they need to be competing with the big teams. And 2 years ago, everyone was saying, listen, Ten Hag comes in, we got to try and our remit is to get closer to Manchester City. They're further away from Manchester City, not just Manchester City, Liverpool, Arsenal, Aston Villa, Tottenham. So it gets tougher and tougher and tougher. And I look at those players and I think, if I said to you in 10 years' time, name me a great Man United player of now, player now, who would you say?
Well, I wouldn't.
You wouldn't, would you?
No.
If you said that about Liverpool, who would you say?
Oh, you'd say Salah, wouldn't you?
Of course you would. Yeah. Manchester City?
Yeah, well, you'd say Silva, or you'd say Foden, or you'd say Kevin De Bruyne, or you'd say Erling Haaland.
So that says it in a nutshell.
Yeah.
10 years' time, you couldn't say he is a great player for Man United.
I want to move you back into you and this moniker that went with you, the governor. Mm. You know, I'm not really interested in its genesis, right? Because I've heard the stories about you playing with snooker and everyone saying that, there's the governor. I'm more interested in about the effect that it had on you and those around you, because if it's a self-anointed governor. And I mean, I remember Stevie Bruce said something once about this cocky little sod comes in and wants to be called the governor.
Mm. Which is a lie. It's a load of bollocks.
Yeah, may well. But, yeah. Okay, I'll let you have that out with Steve.
Well, it is. Well, this is one thing about me. I'll tell you, I don't lie. I don't have to make up stories, you know, about what went on.
No.
So when people say that, just for effect, to make it sound like that
was
the case.
Did it have an effect upon you in terms of put you in a position where people thought well of you?
When I think about it, that doesn't define me as Paul Ince, the governor.
No,
whether it's governor or not governor, you know, I performed to the ability that I perform at week in and week out most weeks. So the governor name wasn't really an issue.
Right.
People made it an issue.
Right.
I didn't make it an issue. People just made it. People loved it. You know, even when I speak to Roy, all right, Gov. Hmm. You know, so it's nothing, it's not a big issue. It's just a bit of fun and something that people see it in a different light if they don't like you.
They can weaponise it and use it against you. How did Ferguson relate to you?
John Lowell said to Sir Alex Ferguson, when Paul comes to you, treat him like I'll treat him, all right? Like a father figure.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what he did.
Okay.
I had no issues with Sir Alex. People seem to think I did, in the way that I left. Well, I didn't leave. I was sold.
Yeah.
You know as well as I know, Simon, when you've got a team full of egos,
yeah,
a team full of opinions, and you've got someone like Sir Alex, who was fiery,
yeah,
being a Scot, you know what I mean? And we're all opinionated. So if someone says something that you don't agree with, you're not just going to sit there and melt, all right?
Mm-hmm.
You're a leader, you know what I mean? You're going to say something. So there's always going to be rows with the managers.
Yeah.
You know, you've experienced it. You know, sure. You've heard about it. So
I've had rows with managers, yeah.
and that's it. There was no more to that whatsoever. And I always hate it when people seem to think that.
Well, I'll tell you why. Because, I mean, look, I mean, I'm looking at some of the things, I think that have been reported about an altercation you had with Alex.
Yeah.
Which is pretty strident. I mean, I've seen altercations in dressing rooms, mm, and I've, no problem. You know, managers have got to put players in their place, and players have got to be sometimes able to express themselves.
Hell yeah.
But there's a strong one, isn't there, between you and Alex after a particular game.
Norwich
away, right? Mm-hmm. And he's gone for you, but you've gone, go fuck yourself, fucking sell me, and God knows whatever else.
You know, you mentioned at the start of the show,
yep,
about being in a gang,
yeah,
and coming out of a gang, but you're always going to have that.
Mentality. Yeah.
And it's how you kind of control that and harness it, okay, that mentality. But it's always in me. It ain't going to change, all right?
It's part of the character.
That's maybe who I am. I'm not prepared. If I feel aggrieved at something, then, you know, I'm going to say how it is. At Norwich, we're 3-1 up. Norwich are vying for the title. You know, I've had a very good game, played really well. Last 5 minutes, I get the ball, I try to beat one or two players, get caught. That was it. So we get into the changing room. Everyone's high-fiving. Well done, boys. Great result. He comes in. You. I'm thinking, what's he going mad for? Just 1-3-1. He said, you ain't Ryan Giggs. You ain't Kunchelskis. You pass the ball. You do this. You do that. And I mean, and I said, what the fuck are you on about? And he's hollering and shouting and getting closer and closer. And I just thought to myself, I'm not having it. I don't care at that time the repercussions of it. I really don't. I'm not prepared when I felt that we've won, everyone's at me, and that's it. So we started effing and blinding. I said, listen, Gaffer, you can go fuck yourself. You know what I mean? I don't give a fuck, Gaffer. You can go fuck yourself, do what you fucking want. You're fucking moaning, we've just won, fuck off. All right? That's what I said. And then all of a sudden he said, don't you talk to me. And he went for me.
Yeah.
And then Brian Kidd stood up, Lee Sharp stood up, and I said, come on in. Again, I'm going back to when I was a kid. I'm not prepared to fucking have it. And they all jumped in X, Y, and Z. And that was it. And that was the end of the conversation. And then, I got home, I said to Claire, I said, the fuck's wrong with me? I did so. I said, what's wrong with me? It's just that red mist descends. Mm. And I just feel like that was it. 3 days later, we were fine.
Yeah. You leave United.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like it ends a little bit sourly.
Maybe.
Because the team's in good nick, isn't it?
Team's in very good nick. I'm still in my prime. You know, I'm like 28.
Yeah.
Was I too big for my boots there? I'm not sure, because he sold Kunchelskis at the same time. He sold Mark Hughes at the same time. And his outlook when I spoke to him was, listen, we've just had a bid from Inter Milan.
Yeah.
We've got a new training ground that we want to build. We've got Nicky Butt coming through the ranks, which I didn't understand, because I said I was only 27, 28. Nicky Butt, as good a player that he was not as good as me. You're sending someone who's in his prime, you know.
So why do you think he did it then?
I think what it was, we lost the FA Cup to Everton.
Right.
Okay. We lost the league to Blackburn.
Right.
We should have beat West Ham last game of the season, and Blackburn lost to Liverpool at Anfield. Okay. That hurt. And maybe he wanted
it's
to
time for a change.
Change things. But the thing was, though, Simon, is that we had this conversation, and I was thought to myself, mate, I've got to go to Italy. That means I've got to speak Italian. I'm thick. I'm thick as shit. I didn't go to school. You know what I mean? I didn't go to school. I didn't. Unless I was, you know. So I thought, am I going to learn another language? So I was panicking. I didn't want to go. I wanted to stay. So I've got Massimo Moratti, a couple of henchmen, and then his vice president in the kitchen in Bremel, where I used to live. So we just, at that time, the agent was Steve Cutler at the time. And all the numbers were sorted out. Next minute, the phone rings. It's Alex Ferguson. He's in Colorado Springs. I've changed my mind, Paul. I want you to stay. Yeah, we've got Nicky Butt coming through, but, you know, you can fight for your place with Nicky Butt, and, you know, it'd be good to learn from you. So I said to Alex, I said, no disrespect, I've got Inter Miami now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm going to give me a contract 10 times as what I'll be getting here. And again, maybe subconsciously, maybe I don't know, but was it again for me that kind of sign of rejection again?
Right.
You know? That's, you know, I keep coming back to that word, didn't
we? Yeah.
I keep coming back to that. Sometimes I don't know why, but sometimes it comes back to me. And, you know, when you give your heart and soul to a club for 6 years and then they don't want you.
Yeah,
and
if you're not with me, then you're against me.
Yeah, that mentality.
But he went on, didn't he? He went on to say two things about you, which I know that he's repudiated.
Yes.
And says, but at the time, he meant them and said them. Mm. He called you a bottler and a big-time Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
To call a player and a player that's built like you're built and the way that you play, a bottler, is a pretty strong observation, isn't it? Why do you think he would say that?
Do you actually think, and that's what you've got people need to understand, and they probably understand now after speaking on this show,
yeah.
I spent half my childhood getting abused on streets, racially abused, okay? Right? It's hard on me. Do you think Sir Alex Ferguson calling me a big-time China bottler is going to affect me?
No,
the reason
no, I
why
don't,
he said it,
I
the
think it's a strange thing to say.
No, and I'm glad he said it, because when he said it and I heard it, that said one or two things for me. You know, it's not going to bother me. All right? You know, he might want me to retort and come back with something different. Yeah. But also, I knew that he was scared of me. He valued how good I was.
Right.
And that's,
but he's saying this when you're gone.
Yeah, and that. But
he wanted you gone.
But he's saying this to Roy Keane and all that lot in the team meeting. Right. And he's saying he's a bottler, he's a big time Charlie. Now, right. He was concerned about me. That's right. Why he said it. Well, if he didn't have any concern about me, he doesn't need to speak to me. He doesn't need to speak about me.
Concerned about you and what? But is he using you to highlight?
Listen, he might be using me to motivate their midfield,
right.
Their team.
Right.
But so if they need motivating because they're playing against me, that means he must value me as a player.
Yeah.
Okay, so obviously the press jumped onto it because that's what he said, yeah. Again, he's come back and said, you know, he's actually apologised to me.
Yeah.
You know, people don't understand. I still used to go around to Sir Alex's house and play snooker with him in Winslow. But I respect him because he apologised.
Yeah.
He said that there's no reason why I should have said that. I was angry, you know, I was trying to get that edge. But it wouldn't affect me.
You go to Italy, into Milan. How did you find Italy? I mean, obviously...
Loved it.
Did you?
I mean, the experience was magical.
Yeah?
It really, really was.
What way?
And you know what? It was hard. Again, it was hard because the first time we landed at Linate Airport, me and my wife, and all the press were there, and one of the pressmen went up to Claire and said, listen, you know, just be careful because most players who come here end up marrying an Italian woman.
Well, that's helpful.
So Claire was in tears. True story. True story. So that wasn't a great start. We couldn't find a place out there. We stayed in the Villa d'Este for about 6 months, which was quite nice. But it was a different kind of style of football. It was a lot slower. Okay, it was a lot slower. It wasn't like hectic like the Premier League is.
Yeah.
And I always kind of thought to myself, how would I adjust out there? Because I'm going from a game...
Crash, bang, wallop,
yeah. Where I'm flying into tackles and, you know, to a game where it's more technically, you've got to be more technically better and be able to deal with things and deal with balls and play the pass. And, you know, I was hitting 60-yard crossfield passes and I was waiting for the crowd to clap.
Yeah.
Nothing happened. No, right. You know, you did that in England, they'd be giving, oh, la, 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 la. So I knew the expectation was there, playing with the likes of Nicola Berti and Zamorano and Bobby Carlos. You have to pinch yourself.
Yeah.
The food was great. The weather was great. The fans adore me.
Yeah.
Just because of my passion for the game. If you ask me what regrets I've got in football, the only two regrets I'll have would be the West Ham shirt and leaving Inter.
So why did you leave Inter?
Family decision. I think I was away with the Inter. My wife called Bell's palsy.
Right.
They wouldn't allow me to see her.
Yeah.
She got a bit despondent with that.
What do you mean they wouldn't allow you to see her?
Because I was away with Inter.
Okay.
So she was panicking, so she's on the main member. So they won't let me see her until we finished down from where we were doing. She got a bit despondent, and she didn't really, you know, wanted to be,
there.
Which was tough, you know what I mean? Because I loved it there. I had another 3 years there. You know, I had to go and see the president who actually brought me to the club and say, I want to leave. And he was like, no, we've just signed Ronaldo for next year. You know, you can have another 5-year contract, any money you want. And I said, you know, Massimo's not about money.
This is about my wife.
This is about my wife. I mean, I was expecting another kid, Daniel. She feels the club have not cared for her. It's something I regret because everything was going well for me. You know what I mean, everything was going swimmingly. Even when I was shit, the fans thought I was great. So it was unbelievable. And again, it was a time of very, there was a lot of racism going on then at the time. You know, I remember, and this was from my own players. My own players, we used to do like sprinting races. And every time we used to beat certain one or two of these players, they used to go, oh, negro de murder.
I know what that means,
And I thought,
black shit, right.
I didn't speak Italian at the time. And I mean, I kept saying it. And eventually it bugged me and I said to Pagney, what's this I keep saying? And he said, but why are they saying that? He said, because that's the way the society they're in. That's the way the fans are. That's where the players are. Again, you always experience that ratio of stuff somewhere else. You think it's gone, but it's still there. We played Napoli away, okay? And we got beat, stayed overnight, got onto the bus. It was about 11:05. Me and Nicola Berti were late, so I'm not proud of, so I don't like being late. So Pavlyuka steps up and starts going, screaming, he's off, you're late. And he smashes Nicola Berti around the head. Like this. And I thought, what are you doing? And he said, shut up, man, negro de murder. And I just went, haven't it? I just went, bang, headbutted him, broke his nose. And that was it. And I'm not proud of that, Simon, don't get me wrong.
But it was your reaction to that.
Again, I've still got that in me to do that, and I don't like that. But after that, I got so much respect from the whole team, and I never used to say that again. And so I had to do something like that.
That extreme to concentrate people's minds on how to behave around you.
How to behave around me.
Or behave properly, full stop.
Behave properly, full stop. But apart from that, I loved it. I loved everything of it, and I was devastated that I had to go back. I really, really was.
Liverpool.
Yeah.
Strange period at Liverpool. You know, Souness had been there before. It hadn't worked out for Graham. A lot of people said, John had said that Graham had wanted to make lots of changes. The culture of Liverpool wasn't right and hadn't been right for some time. Any thoughts in your mind about the ramifications of going for two of the going to the club that's one of the biggest rivals of Man United?
I'd had two very good years at Inter.
Yep.
Okay. I'm coming back now as a 30-year-old.
Yep.
Okay. Man United had the first refusal on me.
Right.
Okay. They could have took me back.
Yeah.
If they wanted to. It's up to them. They didn't want to. Okay. Now, I looked at Liverpool and I thought, well, listen, I've just spent six years in the Northwest. I could have gone to Chelsea. I could have gone to Arsenal. Didn't really want to go back into London. You know what I mean? I liked the Northwest. It was a little bit more quieter for me. I thought London would just cause me trouble. I'm not sure in what way, but I think it caused me trouble. Okay. So I thought Liverpool was perfect for me. It was Michael Owen, I knew David James, I knew Jamie Redknapp, I knew Robbie Fowler. So I was basically going to the club with where my mates were. So it was easy for me to fit straight back in. But I also knew that I was basically going into a culture that needed to change. And I've experienced the winning culture at Manchester United. I know what it takes to be part of a team that has that culture to win things and the sacrifices you have to make to do that. And I wanted to, it was a challenge for me. Could I actually go into that team and change the way people think and what they do? And have that, because you're talking about very, very top players. Michael Owen coming through, Stevie G, Karl-Heinz Riedler, Patrick Berger. Just as good as United had at our time, Simon.
But not the mentality.
But the mentality. As I said, I think they've got sucked into that culture where it didn't matter anymore. You know, we're not bothered. We go and beat teams 5-0, but then we get beat 2-0 and we still come and have a laugh. We still go out. We still go to the nightclub. We still get pissed. Yeah, don't get me wrong. I did that. I'm not, you know, separate myself from that. But there still has to be a demand that if you're going to... Brian Robson was one of the biggest drinkers I've ever known. Right, we used to go out and we used to get absolutely smashed. Absolutely smashed. I guarantee you the next day when we were doing a 5 mile run, he'd be at the top.
Right.
Every time. All right? Because he has to be. You know what I mean? And this is the thing. Players would go out getting smashed, and when we did a running session, they're halfway behind. And that's not the standards you expect from a team that wants to win.
So you go there, and I mean, I spoke to Danny Murphy the other day, who was a young one coming through at the time, and he said two things about, he said, first of all, Paul was a natural leader, and it showed in the dressing room, Paul had expectations and demanded that of others. And I remember Danny said to me, he talked to me about me as a player not being able to kick with my left foot as well as I should do, and getting my ass out in that training. And you said, you get in the right positions, but you don't score enough goals because you can't kick with your left foot the way you should.
And he was a very good player, Danny Murphy.
Yeah, and he took that away from it. And he also took away the fact that you pinned him up against the wall in a dressing room because he made a joke about a wife or a mama or whatever the jokes were.
Yeah.
But he came away with this. His overriding impression of you was an absolute leader and someone demanding that this culture changed. You've been in a relatively unique position of of playing for both Liverpool and Manchester United. Which is the club? Which is the bigger club? And which is the club that has the most... you've got to have that answer. You don't shirk any questions. You've got the balls to say it. So I think Man United is a bigger club than Liverpool. I think Liverpool's a remarkable football club. But I think in the great scheme of things, in terms of history, iconography, achievements,
the
sheer presence of Man United
Of course,
as a football
dreams.
Club.
Yeah, I think it's a bigger
club. So we agree
club.
It's Man United.
Yeah, but then again, I also say that there's nothing like playing in front of the cop.
Which club's got the bigger expectation?
Manchester United, all day long.
That's what I thought.
All day long.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. It has to. And I think, the thing about Man United, you've seen, and you just mentioned Wilfried Zaha.
Yeah.
You've seen big players go there and
shrink
fail.
Shrink underneath it,
And fail because the pressure that it brings on top of you. With Liverpool, they more embrace you. And so that's the difference, you know. And that's why you always hear people say, oh, he's not a Man United player.
Yeah.
You never hear him say about anything else. Not say, well, he's not a Tottenham player, he's not a Liverpool player. He's not a Man United player because it comes with so many things that you've got to deal with. And if you can't, and you shrink, we've seen it happen time and time again.
What do you think's happening with Marcus Rashford?
If Marcus Rashford played in our time, you wouldn't see the Marcus Rashford that you see now.
Right.
Who are the leaders in that change room to pull? Who could Marcus Rashford, again, go to? Who can he look to? You know, Jesse Lingard, who can they look to? You know, and you've seen him last year where he was unbelievable. What's changed from last year? People talk about what he's done outside football. Yeah, that's done and dust. That's gone now. But he still scored 20-odd goals last season. So what's changed from last season to this year? What's gone wrong? Because it looks out of sorts. It looks like a lack of confidence. And yes, we got careful what we say when we talk about mental health.
Yeah.
We all can't just turn to that when things go wrong.
No, it's bloody right we can't. It's used too easily, by the way.
Jesse Lingard was phenomenal for West Ham. Went to West Ham. Was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, not a stank replacer.
Yeah. With Marcus Rashford, I think, like Jesse Lingard, I personally think he needs to go away. I think he needs another challenge.
Right.
I honestly believe that.
You go into management and you go in at Macclesfield. Right. Any resentment from you that you have to go down to that level to manage?
No. I wanted to.
Right.
I wanted to because I did have this kind of notion in my head that because I played for the biggest clubs in the world, that I was going to go straight into a big job.
No.
I never thought that way. Obviously the process was learn my trade, do what's right. And that's why I went down that road.
Right.
And again, when I talk about nerves, the most nervous I've ever been was my first team talk at Macclesfield.
Yeah.
And
why? Why so nervous? You know what you're talking about, don't you?
Not as a manager, no. And I'm talking to a bunch of players who are bottom of the table.
Yeah.
10 points adrift from safety. I've got a little room like the size of this.
Yeah.
When some managers talk, you've got players doing the boots up or looking at programs and that. These players were just fixated on me, Simon.
Yeah.
And I'm standing there and I'm
waiting to be fed.
Yeah, yeah. I'm feeling myself, my hands are sweating. Uh-huh. And I'm thinking,
what am I going to do here? What did you say?
I actually just said, I actually spoke as a captain, as a footballer.
Yeah.
I said, listen, lads, you are where you are. You know what I mean? It's only down to us in this room who's going to get us out of it.
Yeah.
I didn't say try to change it. I didn't try to make them do things that they couldn't do. Because a lot of these things in football is more about mentality, togetherness, spirit. You know what I mean? And I think that's important even at that level. the biggest thing for me was, if we go down,
what does that look like?
That means fucked.
Yeah.
Because people say that Paul can't manage.
Right.
And we managed to stay up. And
yeah,
that for me was like, well, I can manage at that level.
But you go to MK Dons.
Yes.
Pete Winkleman.
Yes.
I know Pete. it's his life, isn't it, MK
yes,
Dons?
It's, yeah. It's,
what was that experience like? You were there for a year. It was, yeah, looks like it was successful.
A wonderful year for me. Really, really good year. We won the league.
Yeah.
We won the St John's Trophy. To manage a team at Wembley,
you know, experience.
It's an experience, honestly. The new Wembley, it's something that you can't take away from me.
You have your year there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a successful year. And then you've got this scenario, which I think is ridiculous. And I'll tell you why I think it's ridiculous. Okay. I'm surprised that John Williams, given his experience, would look at a manager that's been in a job for 18 months in those divisions, irrespective of who he is.
Totally agree.
And irrespective of the achievements he's done, which, by the way, were good achievements. It's a fucking stellar jump, isn't it?
Hell yeah.
To jump from where you were to Blackburn Rovers and all that went with it. And I remember watching, and I've watched it recently, your press conference. You looked like, fucking hell, what's going on here?
Of course I do. And you know what? I knew that. All right? And I've always said that I went to Blackburn too early.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I hadn't done enough in the game as a manager. I put myself on a map that I can manage. I put myself on a map that I can keep teams up. I put myself on a map that I can get teams promoted.
Yeah.
But that's at a low level.
Yeah.
You know, I never knew how much the Premier League changed.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got wind of, oh, you're one of the last three, and I'm thinking, how the fuck am I one of the last three? Right. There was Steve McLaren, there was Sam Allardyce, and there was me. So I'm thinking, well, Sam Allardyce, they're miles experienced than me. They, you know.
Of course. Yeah.
You know,
former England manager, and Steve McLaren.
Didn't even think about it. I never thought for 1 minute that I would get that job. So I was pretty kind of blasé about it. Didn't even do any preparation because I didn't think I was going to get it.
Right.
And then I'm sat at home and then I get a phone call, John Williams, can you come and see him at the house? That only means one thing.
You're getting the job.
I'm shitting myself, you know what I mean? And I just okay. Sit at me,
careful
sit.
What you wish for, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I didn't wish for it. You know what I mean? But I didn't even want it. But I felt I had to take it. I didn't want it because I wasn't ready to take it.
Mm-hmm.
But I just thought, am I going to get this opportunity again, you know, to be a Premiership manager?
Yeah.
Even though I knew deep down I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready for how it grown the Premier League. I wasn't ready for how the players act.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had one player, he couldn't trap a bag of cement. Every day he's walking with a suitcase. I said, where are you going? Oh, I've got a business meeting. I'm thinking, business means you can't fucking track a barrels. You should be out there. You know what I mean? I don't give a monkeys. And I kind of felt that I half expected to go into Blackburn thinking the players or the Premier League players were the same as when I was playing. And they were completely, completely different. When I got sacked, it was kind of like a relief.
I was going to ask you, was it?
Yeah. In a perverse kind of way, it was like, it's over because I've never witnessed, as you rightly said, so many press at my first press conference.
Yeah.
Maybe because I was the first black manager, English manager to manage in the Premier League. Maybe because there was a lot of hooray about me because of how quickly I got to where I got to. To see so many press and people ask me questions, I was like a rabbit in the headlights.
Mm.
You know, normally when I'm at Macclesfield, there's probably one reporter and his dog. You know, now I've got about 40 or 50.
And it was a dog asking the questions. Yeah.
You know, so you can, I get that. You know what I mean? I get that.
You come out, you're out for 9 years, aren't you?
Mm,
and then you come back into Reading.
Mm.
And I remember you coming on with me and Jim.
Remember it well.
And I thought, well, you don't sound that enthused, Paul. Sound like you're doing him a favour.
I was.
I mean, that's out of the frying pan into the fire, that one, isn't it? I mean... Mm. You've got a guy there. I mean, they're in a shit state now, and he doesn't seem to want to be involved anymore. Mm. And what was that experience like for you? I mean, did you meet the owner?
I'd meet the owner obviously once I started working.
Right.
This was just I was sitting indoors on a Friday. I got a phone call from Keir.
Oh, Keir Duraption.
Yeah, your mate.
Yeah, my mate. Yeah.
And and he said, "Listen, I think the manager's going to leave after the Preston game."
Yeah.
Oh, he might even leave before Saturday morning. He said, you live up that way. You fancy taking a job if he goes before kickoff or, you know, you got Birmingham on the Tuesday. Would you want to take that game? I said, so I spoke to Claire. I said, I've been out of it too long, darling. And again, it wasn't that I didn't see myself going to Reading for 2-3 years.
No.
I thought I was just going there to...
fix a problem.
Fix a little problem. Because yeah. I said to Kirsten, I'll come, I'll do the Birmingham game, find a manager.
Why is Kia phoning you? Yeah, all right, yeah.
Yeah.
Because he's the one that sold them all the bleeding players. Took their wage bill 150% over. But I always fix the problems that I create, do you?
So we played at Birmingham on the Tuesday. We win 2-1.
Yeah.
And then you start getting that little kind of...
yeah, buzz.
In your stomach. You know, you're back on the training ground, you're back on the grass, you're back coaching. But my mindset was always, find a manager.
Yeah.
I'll come and do it. What turned me and what made me want to stay was my son was playing.
Right, Tom.
Thomas.
Yeah.
When your son's away, you don't see him all the time. Yeah. Now I'm seeing my son every day.
Right.
Maybe it was a selfish kind of thing to do. But just to see him for that month was great.
You got them going a little bit, didn't you?
Yeah.
And then you stayed on. And then all of a sudden it starts to fall away again, doesn't it? And you're dealing with a whole raft of things. You're dealing with a ridiculous management structure, which is allowing wage bills to go through the ceiling, so you're getting sanctioned left, right and centre.
Correct.
You've also got an owner that's now not paying his wages on time. How difficult is that an environment for you to manage in?
Very difficult, because you're trying to get the players just to focus on the game. And you hear it all the time. Listen, players should just focus on what they can do. But when the noise is coming and people talking to you and the chef's talking to you, oh, we've lost one of our chefs because we can't afford to pay no more, you've got to start. Because obviously players now used to get food for nothing. Now they've got to pay for their own foods. You know what I mean? And I'm thinking, and we're still trying to win football matches at the same time. I know with this embargo, which is the hardest thing I've ever had to experience, I talked to you before about wanting to build a team. That's why I was told that once I kept them up, then there'd be no embargo be lifted. We'd be able to trade in the market under a certain figure, under a certain average wage, but we'd be able to bring players in, which was actually a load of rubbish, total lie. So when we were told that you can't do that, and all you can do is bring in loan players on £2,000 a week, and the average had to be £5,000, and you're trying to kind of play in a championship, it was the hardest thing ever. You know, and you're bringing in players who had no pre-season because nobody wants them. And then they come to you and they break down after 2 minutes. Like, you just don't know where you're coming or going. And it was a sad ending, to be fair. I loved our time at Reading.
Yeah.
I really did. So I loved being there. But it was just the way it ended, you know, because I felt, you know, the remit was to stay in the league. Okay, that was a remit.
Yeah, and that's what you were achieving.
Yeah, all the talk at the top was, listen, as long as we stay in the league, Paul, next year, you'll be here. Same old twaddle that they gave me the year before. And we were doing that. And we knew the 6 points was hanging over us. And the players knew it. You know, it was in the press. And, you know, we'd win a game and the players wouldn't be happy because I know that's coming off in a month's time. And don't matter how much a leader and manager or coach are.
There's only so much you can do.
So much you can do. And they're going home and they'll start worrying and start panicking. And then to lose your job with 4 games to go.
Yeah.
I don't get it. I honestly don't get it. Sack a manager with 4 games to go because the team's in a relegation, because the club...
Has got sanctions. Yeah.
It's pure madness. And then to put Noel White in now, who's a lovely, lovely guy, don't get me wrong, no experience. You know, I hate to see where the club is and to see where they are now. And it's a sad, sad sight for fans. And you just feel for the fans. I feel for the people. I speak to a few girls there who work in a canteen and work in an admin area. And some of them are gone. I thought, oh, she was nice. And people don't see that.
No.
People don't see that. I don't see the ones who get sacked and all that because of this.
I want to get on to a subject that often comes up with black managers. And it came up recently when I spoke to John Barnes. It came up recently when I spoke to Les Ferdinand. And I think it sits in your psyche as well. But perhaps you can tell me something different. The perception that the English football system and structure of English football is weighted against black managers getting opportunities. Where do you sit on that?
I feel that you have to be very successful as a black manager for people to realise that black management can actually manage. Okay? Now, my thoughts on this is that we have a lot of black players in the Premier League. These players want a lot of money.
Yeah.
Okay? When they finish football, I don't think there'd be very many who want to go into management. One, because they find they don't need to.
Yeah.
Two, the punditry avenue is there.
But that's available to both black and white managers, isn't it?
But then again, it's not, because if you look at punditry now, I'm not saying it's wrong, but this just ticking this PC box, you know, we've got a lot of black people on doing punditry, okay? I think a lot of players will go that way. Hopefully they don't. These players do not see an avenue to go into management.
But this is my question.
And then. this is the nub of the question.
Mm. Because do you believe that there isn't an avenue?
I came at the game for 8 years. You know what I mean? When I left Blackpool, I didn't have one club or someone say, oh, Paul, come and have a chat with us. I don't expect it to. You know what I mean? I don't expect to because I was, you know what I mean? I came out of Reading last year. You know what I mean? People should have said, oh, he's done a good job there.
Yeah.
Because sitting in the bar, go X, Y, and Z. You put yourself in for a couple of jobs, you don't hear nothing. Okay?
Right.
I want black players to come out when they finish their career and feel that they've got to, it's not just come easy. They're not just going to hand it to you.
No, neither should it be.
You've got to keep knocking on the door, you've got to keep knocking on the door, keep knocking on the door. And when I see managers, and I'm white managers, get jobs after failures, and they get jobs after jobs after jobs, they fail, they get back another job, and you think to yourself,
why is that happening?
And I don't know the answer to that.
And that's my question.
I don't know the answer to that. But I don't want people to lose confidence in the system. You know what I mean? I think we as, and when I say we, I don't mean black men. We have to come together on this.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of people have got their eyes shut on this matter.
Well, let's talk about your favourite subject now. You and your England career.
Oh, I thought you were talking about golf.
No, I don't want to talk about
boxing. Boxing or something like that.
How do you look back on it? 53 caps. Short-changed on caps? Should have got more?
Yeah, I feel I should have done. I was, you know, I'm disappointed with that. Really disappointed. I think I made my debut in 92 in Spain, Santander. Should have been there. It's not being arrogant because I'm not that way, but I felt, you know.
You were 25 then, you know.
Yeah, I was playing well, you know, for United. And I just felt like I should have been there a lot longer than that. And it's funny, that, believe it or not, the first, we played Leeds at Old Trafford, beat them 2-0. Dave Batty was playing, McAllister, and then the late Gary Speed. absolutely hammered them. And England were travelling on the Sunday the next day. So I'm in the players' lounge having a beer. Well, not a beer, I was having a glass of wine. I don't drink beer. And I think it was wine. It might have been vodka.
It was something.
It was a liquid anyway, sorry. And kiddo comes down to myself, Fergie wants to see you upstairs. So I went upstairs to see Sir Alex. He said, what's that? He said, Graham Taylor's been on the phone. You're in the England squad. I said, no, I'm not going. What do you mean you're not going? I said, I'm not going. I felt I should have been there a year ago. You know what I mean? He's only seen the game today on Sky, so I'm not going. So then Fergie made me up to listen. Just spoke to Graham. He said, if you go, you're playing. So I said, starting. He went, yeah, you're starting. So I said,
oh. Okay.
So I started having.
I'm not a big time, Charlie.
No, but you know what? Because when you're playing well, you feel like you're better than the players that are playing that position. If I'm going to travel that way, I want to play.
Yeah.
I want to play football, you know. And we lost 1-0, but I played really well, and that was it. And I love playing for England.
Yeah.
I loved it.
What was it like to be given the captaincy?
Graham Taylor is just simple, which is the captain of the tournament. You know, there was a couple of these kind of tough macho man that I am. You know what I mean? I was trying to hold back my tears. You know what I mean?
It's a bloody honour to lead your country.
It's just an honour. And I just think, I went into the press and there was loads of them. And they said, first question they said was, Paul, what's it like to be the first black England captain? And I said, listen, I'm here because I'm the England captain. It doesn't matter if I'm black, white, pink, purple. And that's the first question they asked me. And that's not to say that I don't appreciate my heritage and where I come from and my roots. It's just that I don't see colour like people see colour. Mm-hmm. I just see achievements and what they're doing, what they're like as people. That's the way I am, you know. And if I don't like you, it's not because you're white or black or purple.
I just don't like you.
It's as simple as that. So I just said, firstly, it's about being the captain of England, you know, against the great players that I've got out there, Teddy Sheridan, Wrighty, all those players, Les. You know what I mean? Great players, I'm going to lead this team out. And that was it. But they tried to make a big thing about it. I never did.
Well, that's the media.
Okay.
Right?
And it was only when I got back from America and I must have had about four sackfuls of fair mails. I mean, seriously, Simon, must have been about 4,000 or 5,000 letters. You know what I mean? Mm. And me and Claire, my wife, we went through all of them. And a lot of them were from mums and dads from unprivileged backgrounds. You know what I mean? Who read my story, what I've come through, and it all relates back to when I first started in Diggs and Dagenham, you know, how you know, you can get out of that kind of environment, yeah, establishment, and I was like the role model to them. And that gave me a lot more pressure, really, than being a first backing captain. It was the effect that I had on
other people
rather than just myself, because I'm a team player. I always play for the team. And that brought a lot to me. But it's only probably after the Rome game where I captained England and Rome that I kind of sat down, and I was nervous that game. I was really nervous because I thought Tony Adams should have been the captain. You know, there's bigger players in that team who should have been captain. But I think that's probably the 9th or 10th time that I captained England. But the enormity of the game, you know, we missed out in World Cup 94 in USA, which we should have gone to. And I was beginning to wonder if I'd ever play in a big, big tournament. And we knew we had to go to the Lions Den in Rome. I was still in Italy at the time. And then obviously Glenn knocked on the door. It was funny because in the morning we were training and Wright had a chance that he might be playing. And he was so nervous in the training. Every time we got the ball to him, he kept losing it. I said, "Righty, get hold of the fucking ball. You could be playing tonight. You need to liven up, son." You know what I mean? The whole session, he was horrendous like that. So me and Wright are very good friends. We got into a room, so we share each other in the same rooms. And it's about 4 o'clock. All of a sudden, a knock on the door, just woken up. So who's that? He said, "Oh, it's a gaffer, Glenn." And Wright's like, "Fuck it, I'm not playing. He's come here to tell me that I'm not playing." I said, "Well, you were fucking shit in training. What do you expect?" You know what I mean? So I opened the door and said, "Can I have a quick word?" I said, "Yeah, of course you can." So I thought, hang about, maybe I'm the one who's not playing. So I just wanted to let you know that you know, I went to be my captain tonight and lead the team out. And I went back in and told Wright, and he was more excited than what I was. Mm. And that just says something about Wright, the man. And, you know, I got home. And I kind of just, you know, you look back in your career. Mm-hmm. I still had another few years at, you know, Liverpool and that, but just from the pinnacle to play for your country. Yeah. Never envisioned I'd ever come to captain my country. Mm. So just for me to just sit back and just think where I've come from, you know, if I was going to look at my career, you know, I'm very comfortable. I'm comfortable with my career. But,
yeah, so you should be. It was a stellar
career. And I'm happy. I'm more happy because people say who was the biggest influence on my career. And, you know, I always say my wife. Mm. I always say my wife because, you know, she's been through so much, you know, from the early stages. I think we'll be 34 years married in June.
Well done,
yeah. 34 years. It's a long time. You know, yeah. I fucked up.
I just lost about 34 months. Minutes, me and most relationships.
Yeah, but it is what it is. You know what I mean? And she's gone all through where having to come up here, lose her job, a good job, having to go forward.
But she's been behind you.
Social stuff. She's been behind me. She's supported me. You know, and, you know, it takes a lot to be a footballer's wife. Mm-hmm. It fucking does. You're away all the time and she's got to bring up children and you miss out on a lot. And she's been massive in my life. And again, having that stability, I think that was the key for me in my career was having stability, you know. And, you know, she gave me that. Well, John Lowell gave me that. So Alex gave me
very
that.
Very good.
And, you know, I'm today.
What's next for you?
I want to get back in.
Yeah.
You know, as I said,
You've got it back in. You want to go back into management?
Yeah, I loved it. I love my year at Reading. It's got me reinvigorated again. And, you know, I'd love to try and get back in if I can. If not, then it's fine. It's fine. Time and I'm happy. You know, I can do some radio stuff. I can do some TV stuff. As I said, I always said to myself, I'll work till I'm 60. Because I want to spend the rest of my...
What are you now, 56?
56. Because I want to spend life with my family, my wife and kids and grandchildren. I don't want to be a Roy Hodgson or Neil Warnock and works from 80, and then I want to spend life with my family and grandchildren and kids, and that's why I've always said 60, and I'm done, mate, I'm done.
Fair enough. Well done, Paul. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thanks for being up front.
Thank you very much, Simon.
Well done, mate.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Up Front with me, Simon Jordan, is brought to you by William Hill. Future episodes can be found on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. 18 plus, please gamble responsibly.